I feel very honored to be giving this lecture and connected with you, Yaravant, because of my enormous enthusiasm and respect for the astronomy program here that you have shaped so beautifully over the years and the great times I have had here. I've been a visitor here many, many, many times over the decades since the early 1970s, and it's in some sense sort of a home away from home. And I'm grateful to Chuck for endowing this lectureship and making this possible. Thank you. I'm going to talk today about probing what I like to call the warped side of the universe with gravitational waves and numerical relativity, neither of which tools we had as useful, workable tools a decade ago. And so this is a whole new subject, a whole new area of science made possible by breakthroughs in computing technology, well, numerical relativity technology. It's not just computing, but it's algorithms. It's understanding the Einstein equations much more deeply mathematically. And by the gravitational wave technology that this superb team that I'm associated with has developed. By the warped side of the universe, I mean phenomena and objects that are made from warped space and time entirely or in considerable measure. So in reality, although I don't list it here on the next slide, I would include neutron stars there, for example, because in a neutron star, the gravitational potential energy is a good 15% or so of the total energy. So gravity is a major component. Warped space-time is a major component in a neutron star as well. But I will focus to a great extent on warped space-time without matter. And later I'll discuss neutron stars and things that do have matter. But the phenomena I mean are things like black holes. I'll show an icon here that I'll explain later. The Big Bang singularity in which the universe was born. Naked singularities, which might or might not exist, probably not, but we will be searching for them with gravitational waves, as I'll explain. Our universe is a brain living in a higher dimensional bulk, as occurs in the movie Interstellar, and as occurs according to string theory. But also the idea that there may be macroscopic extra dimensions, as Lisa Randall and Raman Sundaram suggested some years ago. Cosmic strings, which Ira was just which David Chernoff was just bending my ear about a few minutes ago, and which I'll talk about briefly later on, and gravitational waves. So here is a list of things that are basically made from warped space and time. And then there are also things like neutron stars where the warping is very important, but not necessarily dominant. And let me begin with black holes. A spinning black hole shown in this little icon, this is meant to be the horizon of the black hole. As it spins, it drags space into a whirling motion around itself. And I'm going to focus a lot of attention on that whirling motion of space and what it does to phenomena related to black holes. We visualize the shape of space around a black hole, the warping of space, by imagining taking an equatorial slice through the black hole. That's a two-dimensional surface. It's warped because Einstein says that space-time is warped by the matter and energy present in space-time. And so if you take it out and embed it in a flat space, it has to bend down in the flat space in order to accommodate itself to the flat space. And so we get diagrams like this famous diagram that the warped space around a spinning black hole looks like a trumpet horn. And so you have the warped space. You have the horizon down here, which if we restore one more spatial dimension, changes from being a circle into being a spheroid. We have the color coding showing the slowing of time. As I discussed in my public lecture yesterday, yellow time flows at 1/10 the speed that it is far away. In black, it's time slows to a halt at the horizon, as seen by anybody who hovers there, refusing or managing not to fall through. And we have the dragging of space into motion, whirling motion with an angular velocity that is proportional to the length of the white arrows. And in the language of general relativity, you have the three metric that's encoded in this shape. you have the so-called lapse function, which is encoded in the color coding, the slowing of time, and you have the so-called shift function, which is the length of those arrows. And so there's precise mathematics that underlies this. Now, the question, of course, arises, what warps the space and time? And the answer is the energy that's contained in the warping, that the black hole is held together by nonlinear self-interaction. It's what we call a gravitational soliton. Objects that hold themselves together by nonlinear interactions are often called solitons. The status of black hole research in 2006, when my story begins, is that we knew about the theory of quiescent spinning black holes. We'd never seen compelling evidence at that time for spinning black holes. We had compelling evidence for black holes, but at that time we didn't, by contrast with today, we didn't have compelling evidence that black holes spin or spin by at substantial speeds. And wildly dynamical black holes, as when black holes collide, we understood nothing, almost nothing about them except order of magnitude estimates, and of course they had never been observed. And as you're well aware, that has all changed now. On the theoretical side, through computer simulations, on the observational side, through gravitational wave observations. And that is then the essence of my story and where that is leading us and what we have learned by these two new tools. But it was as though in 2006 we had only seen the surface of the ocean on a calm day, quiescent ocean. We'd never seen the ocean in a storm or with crashing ocean waves. And we wanted to know how does, in this case now, not the ocean, but space-time, which can be warped according to Einstein, how does it behave in a storm? In a storm in particular, for example, created by collisions of two black holes. This then is the topic of the nonlinear dynamics of curved space-time, and it does involve some of the deepest issues in the nature of space and time and some of the most interesting astrophysical phenomena. It was actually John Wheeler, who was my PhD advisor, who back in the era when I was his graduate student, gave us exhortations, almost religious exhortations, that you should go in and you should figure out how curved space-time behaves when it's highly dynamical. He called this geometric dynamics. And this is Johnny lecturing at a 60th birthday celebration for Willie Fowler, who's sitting in here, those of you who knew Johnny or Wheeler. Lecturing about geometric dynamics. And so we tried and we failed. Everybody fell flat on their face. Nobody could do it. You couldn't solve the equations analytically. You could make order of magnitude estimates. You could try to figure out some things by perturbation theory. That taught us a little bit, but not very much. And so we had to wait until, or part of the community worked very hard to develop the tools, but we had to wait for the tools of numerical simulations and gravitational wave observations. It was epitomized for the numerical simulations by the SXS Simulating Extreme Space-Times project, which is a joint Cornell, Caltech, and now other universities project, and gravitational waves observations by the LIGO project. So we now have those tools, and they've been teaching us a lot. So I want to begin with numerical simulations. And this is a small piece of what's done in these numerical simulations, but it's the piece that has driven my interest the most. Of course, numerical simulations have been under development since the 1960s, just like gravitational wave technologies. They've been the same period of time. The first attempts to do numerical simulations were numerical solutions of Einstein's equations that I know of that got anywhere were by Bryce DeWitt in the 1960s. He was working at Livermore at the time. He was involved in some work on design of bombs. And they needed to work in curvilinear coordinates. He carried curvilinear coordinates over into that particular field. And then he said to himself, OK, well, if I can use curvilinear coordinates for this, why don't I use it to solve Einstein's equations? And so he initiated that. In parallel with Ray Weiss and before him, Joe Weber initiating gravitational wave experiment. But the big success in numerical simulations has only come in the last 10 years, and they are beginning to teach us about geometric dynamics. And so the context in which I'll talk about this mostly, though I'll discuss other contexts as well later, is black hole collisions. This is a diagram that was drawn by an artist at my following a sketch by me when we were just starting the LIGO project of what we wanted to see, two black holes going around each other, colliding and merging. We knew before these simulations began that the power output in gravitational waves in order of magnitude was 100 times the luminosity of the universe, 100 times larger than the total power output of all the stars in the universe put together. And that was true regardless of the masses of the black holes. Just if the masses were small, low, this would happen quick, and you would get out a few percent of the rest mass of the two, few percent of the masses of the black holes would go into gravitational wave energy. If the black holes were huge, then the collision would take longer, and we would still get out a few percent of the total mass of the black holes. So we knew that. We knew there would be no electromagnetic waves emitted whatsoever unless there happened to be an accretion disk around the two black holes close enough to the to the black holes to be perturbed by the merger. And that's a long shot, and there has been no evidence of that with an electromagnetic counterpart in the first major gravitational wave detection that was announced in February. So the energy comes off all in gravitational waves, but the key thing is that the details of the collision, the geometrodynamics, are encoded in the gravitational waves waveform. And this was my fanciful hope for the what the waveforms might look like back in, that was in the 1980s when we were embarking on LIGO as an organized project. It turned out to be less interesting than that so far, unfortunately. But nevertheless, encoded in the waves is an enormous amount of information that does tell us about geometrodynamics. So an example of a numerical simulation, identical black holes not spinning. This is one of the, this is the first simulation done by the SXS collaboration. Cornell and Caltech since expanded to CETA, Cal State Fullerton, Oberlin, Washington State University. Do I have them all in there this time? Led by Kidder, Pfeiffer, Scheele, and Tucholsky, the key people, the authors of the primary authors of the SPEC code, Saul Tucholsky, overseeing them and teaching everybody how do you do this. And then he's superb at turning the details over to his younger collaborators, and they do fabulous things. I'm showing you is not actually. Originally, when I made that slide, I was going to show you the first simulation, but I slipped in there the simulation of the source of gravity that LIGO saw, and so it's a little different from the first simulation. But I showed this also in my popular talk, except I did not show the apparent horizons of the black holes, which are sitting up here, going around and around. You see the warped space of the black holes. You see the shift function, or more precisely, the negative of the shift function that shows, in some sense, the dragging of space into motion. The lapse function that shows the slowing of time, red down inside here. Time is enormously slow. The horizons are deep down inside there. And we watch it go as we did last night. And I mean, it's just a pleasure for me to watch this. After all the decades of effort to be able to simulate a generic situation, that these guys could do a simulation for what was observed and make these beautiful, beautiful then visualizations is really wonderful. So you'll see when the black holes merge up at the top, you see the warped space time down in here. Now it's headed toward merger. It will be paused at merger. These are apparent horizons. With apparent horizons, you see the two black holes, original horizons, sitting inside the common apparent horizon, a little different than what's called an event horizon, but that's more technical than I want to get into. But it's really beautiful seeing this visualization. But there are problems with this, in fact, that I did not discuss last night. This is a acknowledgement of the people and institutions involved in this. There's too little of the space-time geometry depicted in this way. Also, I didn't write it down here, but also the actual details of the arrows and the shapes and the colors are rather gauge dependent. They depend on how you slice up space-time into space plus time. The computer does it in a manner that is guaranteed that the computer won't crash. And in some sense, that means it's doing it in a manner that will make things as smooth as possible and as calm as possible, as unwild as possible. But nevertheless, the precise details depend on how you slice space, time running up, space running horizontally. Just how do you slice space time to get this three-dimensional surface? And what I'm going to tell you next, there's also some dependence on that, but not nearly to the same degree. But the bigger issue is too little of the information is depicted in this way. And so as these simulations started to work, as Saul and his colleagues started to have real success, I sat down with part of the team, some here at Cornell at the time, some at Caltech, John Derbrink in South Africa, me. This is taken from a video conference. We did all this collaboration by video link. And we figured out new ways to visualize space-time curvature. I want to talk about that for a few minutes. So what I was showing you before was a visualization of the metric of space-time. I'm going to show you now the visualization of what's called the Riemann curvature tensor, which is the local thing that produces forces, the tidal forces, for example, that raise the tides on the moon. It's the Riemann curvature tensor does that. I wanted to highlight that the key person who had the initial idea for this was actually Rob Owen, who was a postdoc here at Cornell at the time, and in Saul's group. And then everything flowed from there. First I'm going to introduce the concept of horizon or frame-dragging vorticity. This is the same word as used in fluid mechanics to describe something that's very similar. So if you have an observer above the black hole, she can be falling in or she can be hanging, it doesn't matter, or standing. As she looks at a gyroscope at her feet, her head will see the gyroscope going around and around in a counterclockwise direction. And if her feet look at a gyroscope at her head, her feet will see a gyroscope going around and around in what her head, what appears to be a counterclockwise direction. It's the same way as if you take a wet towel and you wring the water out of it, your left hand will see your right hand going around counterclockwise. Your right hand will see your left hand going around counterclockwise. So there's a twist to space in that sense. This is caused because the dragging of space into motion is bigger near her feet than it is near her head. And so that's that differential dragging of space into motion, or in technical language, the differential frame dragging that causes this. But it is an actual twist, a physical twist of space that shows up in gyroscopic motions. And so I've painted red the regions that have counterclockwise vorticity on the black hole's horizon, blue the regions that have clockwise vorticity. The vorticity is the angular velocity of the gyroscope here relative to that one there divided by this person's height. And so that's something that's independent of the person's height. And so it's something that mathematically embodies a piece of the Riemann curvature tensor. A horizon vortex then is a region with high vorticity, high large twist of space. So there are two horizon vortices, a red vortex or counterclockwise vortex here, blue or clockwise vortex down there. Okay, now how about outside the black hole? Now I'm going to get a little bit technical. This is probably, surely the most technical slide in the talk, but I want to explain just how this is done. When we slice space-time into space plus time, so time's running upward, space running horizontally, the electromagnetic field tensor, a second-rank anisometric tensor, splits up into the electric field and the magnetic field, which are much more familiar. Those are vector fields. And we visualize those by using field lines. So the field lines between two ends of a bar magnet, for example, magnetic field lines, or between a positive charge and a negative charge, again, dipole magnetic field lines, or the magnetic field lines around the Earth. And they're very familiar, and they're a powerful tool for visualizing electric and magnetic fields. Similarly, this Riemann curvature tensor that embodies the local warping or curvature of space-time. It splits up into two parts, an electric part and a magnetic part, but these are symmetric trace-free tensors mathematically. The electric part describes tidal gravity. It raises the tides on the Earth when it's produced by the moon. The magnetic part describes this frame dragging, this differential frame dragging, the twist of space. And we visualize then these electric and magnetic part of the Riemann curvature tensor, the tidal field and the frame drag field, by networks of field lines. And so in particular, if I talk about vortex lines and their vorticities, from the frame drag field, an integral curve of the eigenvector n of the frame drag field is called a vortex line. Its eigenvalue is called its vorticity. And so physically, the vorticity along this vortex line is just what I said before. It's the angular velocity of space or of a gyroscope at her feet relative to one at her head, divided by her height. And so you have this physical vorticity, which is the dragging of space. And basically, space is twisting around the blue lines in a clockwise manner. It's twisting around the red lines in a counterclockwise manner. And this depicts the frame drag field, or the magnetic part of the Riemann tensor, in terms of field lines, and it's a pattern around a spinning black hole. We now understand that's what half of the Riemann curvature tensor looks like. It is this pattern of vortex lines around which space twists. Regions of large twist, large vorticity, we call vortexes, and so there's a vortex coming, counterclockwise vortex coming out of the north pole of this black hole and a clockwise vortex coming out of the south pole of the black hole. So black holes have vortices, but vortices of twisting space rather than vortices of whirling water like you're accustomed to in fluid dynamics, but a rather similar kind of a concept. Okay, now the interesting thing is what happens to these vortices when two black holes collide. And so I'm going to show you the most interesting collision is the simplest one. It's a head-on collision between two black holes. So these two black holes, this one has its blue clockwise vortex sticking up, its red vortex sticking down. Those are the vortex lines. I'm going to remove the vortex lines and just watch what happens on the horizon. That's simpler. Watch the horizon vortices. These two black holes are going to collide and merge, and so let's watch that, and it'll pause. I'll pause the merging. So you now have one. This is the absolute event horizon of the black hole. It's the point of no return. You fall through there, and you never come out. And this black hole now has four vortices on it. It has a clockwise vortex here, counterclockwise one there. Just back behind here is a blue one, and back behind there is a red one. So there are four vortices on a black hole. It turns out black holes don't like to have four vortices. They only like to have two. And so this black hole is going to shed those extra two vortices in some manner, basically by them fighting with each other in what turns out to be a very fascinating manner that was first discovered in these numerical simulations. We now understand it a little better from some analytic perturbation theory analyses. But a key point here is that once these vortices have been created, they each robustly retain their individuality. So now we're going to watch these two black holes collide and see what happens to their vortices. And remember, the upper right is blue, the upper left is red to start out. So we'll just let this go and watch the upper right, for example. So the vortices are, in some sense, fighting with each other and exchanging vorticity. And this oscillates and radiates away the oscillation energy of the black hole as gravitational waves. And I will now explain how these gravitational waves are generated. But it's this exchange of vorticity that's really quite interesting to see. Again, a discovery made through numerical relativity. We never understood this before. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So I've done the simplest case possible in order to have it be nice and pedagogical. Okay, so a key thing that happens is that when this goes green, there are no vortex lines sticking through the black hole. And so during these oscillations, what's happening is that the blue vortex lines and the red vortex lines are popping off of the black hole. They actually, and so here you have the red ones. The red ones have reconnected when the black holes merge, and so the vortex lines go from here down to the red vortex on the backside. The blue vortex lines go from here around to the backside, and this is a result of reconnection of vortex lines in the process of the collision, which is itself an interesting process. But what happens is each time this goes green, the vortex lines pop off the black hole, they embrace each other, and they form a torus like a smoke ring. And you get a sequence of tori propagating outward at the speed of light. And these are gravitational waves. These are tori with the vortex lines winding around the tori. The color coding has been sort of lost on here. The vortex lines going in one direction should be blue, going the other direction should be red. Each of these actually contains both clockwise and counterclockwise vortices. But what happens is these vortices expand outward through an analog of Maxwell's equations, and the mathematics is very, very similar to Maxwell's equations. The moving vortices generate tendex lines which stretch and squeeze. That's the other half of the Riemann curvature tensor. There's tendex lines that stretch and squeeze. In the same way as a moving magnetic field in electromagnetism generates an electric field. And so you wind up with these tendex lines, which are the integral curves of the eigenvectors of the tidal field part of the Riemann tensor. They are wrapping around the vortices like that. In this case, it's the stretching tendex lines, and the squeezing tendex lines are wrapped around the small part of the vortex. You now have this structure of intertwined vortex lines and tendex lines in the form of smoke rings traveling outward at the speed of light, and they are the gravitational waves that arrive at Earth in this case, and that LIGO detects. But LIGO feels only the tendex lines that stretch and squeeze. Does not feel the vortex lines. It's designed to feel the tendex lines, not designed to feel the vortex lines. And so the plane gravitational wave that heads toward Earth, it has the stretching and squeezing tendex lines, that has the twisting vortex lines, and they're superimposed on each other, and that's what the plane wave looks like when it's far from its source. In an orbiting collision, which is a more generic situation of what we saw in LIGO, it's a little different. In that case, the vortex lines swing out around the black hole like water from a whirling sprinkler head. And so you have the clockwise vortex lines and the counterclockwise vortex lines swinging around as the black hole spins. And then they induce, through their motion, the tendex lines, which intertwine with them and produce gravitational waves. And this is the total pattern, then, at late times of the vortex lines themselves. Red ones coming off of this region, part of the horizon of the black hole, blue ones coming off of that part of the horizon, and it's an intertwined pattern of vortex lines, of vortices. And near the black hole, these are basically attached to the black hole, and it's the near zone vortices, or vortexes, as we sometimes say, turning around and around that generate the gravitational waves. Okay. So it's rather beautiful to see this manner of production of the gravitational waves. I'm now going to go on. I could say a lot more about that, but I want to discuss a number of other aspects of what we're learning through numerical simulations and gravitational wave observations. And so I want to go on and just remark that when one does a simulation of a black hole, of a neutron star black hole binary, this is an early simulation by Francois Foucault, Matthew Duez, Larry Kidder and Saul Tucholsky, Matt Dewey, Larry Kidder and Saul Tucholsky. The black hole is three times heavier than the neutron star. The neutron star is blue, the black hole is black. The black hole's spinning about that axis. And so the orbital plane is not the equatorial plane of the black hole. It turns out that the effect of the vortices in this case is to drag the neutron star matter into the orbital plane, into the equatorial plane of the black hole. And so you're going to watch what happens when the black hole's tendex lines, its tidal fields, reach out, tear the neutron star apart, and then the moving neutron star matter interacts with the vortex lines, which throw it up into this different plane, up out of the original orbital plane and up into the equatorial plane of the black hole. And yes, you're dealing with 1.5 solar masses of nuclear matter being ripped apart by the tendex lines and being thrown up into a new plane by the vortex lines. Just seeing this, you get a sense that there's a lot of power in the Riemann tensor in both the tendex lines and vortex lines. So just let it go. It's already being thrown up out of, this was the original orbital plane. It's now torn apart. A large fraction of the mass goes down the black hole, and some of the mass remains in an accretion disk around the black hole. And of course, this is the foundation for what we call Mulde-Messenger astronomy. From this event, you see not only gravitational waves, but you see gamma rays and neutrinos produced by the hot nuclear matter that's been exposed when the neutron star is torn apart. Of course, we don't see it yet, but I think we're more or less guaranteed to be seeing it with advanced LIGO sometime in the next several years. And so that leads me then to the second half of the talk. I want to talk for a little while about gravitational waves as probes of the warp side of the universe. I will return to simulations toward the end and remark about some other simulations that teach us in another context about the warp side of the universe. But I want to talk now for a little while about gravitational waves. Now, I want to make some general remarks that are familiar to most of you probably, but I think are well worth reminding ourselves of at this era when we're embarking on gravitational wave astronomy as a whole new way to understand the universe. It's the contrast between electromagnetic and gravitational waves. Electromagnetic waves in the astrophysical context, well, they are oscillations of the electromagnetic field propagating through space-time. Gravitational waves are oscillations of the fabric of space-time itself. Could hardly be more different. Electromagnetic waves, astrophysically, are almost always incoherent superpositions of emission from particles and atoms and molecules, whereas gravitational waves are emitted coherently by the bulk motion, I should have said, of matter and energy. In a black hole, it's the energy that's tied up, or mass that's tied up in the warping of space-time. Electromagnetic waves are all too easily absorbed and scattered between their source and the astronomer. Gravitational waves are never significantly absorbed or scattered, even near the Planck era, near the beginning of the universe. And so they're a very powerful way of seeing things that cannot be seen electromagnetically. Implications, many gravitational wave sources won't be seen electromagnetically because of these enormous differences, and that's the case of the first gravitational wave discovery from the black hole binary. And big surprises are likely because of the radical difference between the two types of radiation. There are, as I remarked yesterday in the public lecture, there are four frequency bands in which they're likely to be open for gravitational waves in the next decade or two. The high frequency band, 10 to 10,000 hertz oscillation frequencies, has already been opened by LIGO now. Virgo, I'll discuss this a little bit. There are other Earth-based instruments that will come on board and participate in this soon. LISA, and at some future time, what's called the Big Bang Observatory, are analogs of LIGO in space, with spacecraft being tracking each other with light beams. And LISA will operate in a frequency band between a tenth of a hertz and 10 to the minus 5 hertz. Again, here, 4 orders of magnitude, frequency band, 3 orders of magnitude. So these are very, very broad bands. I remind you, the optical band is like a factor of 2 or so. It's a tiny band compared to what you're dealing with here. pulsar timing arrays, which are likely to succeed sometime, I would say, in the next 5 years or so, operate in what I like to call the very low frequency band, 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 9 hertz. And the way this works is worth emphasizing is you look at a pulsar in the sky, it's a really good clock. It's a spinning neutron star. You have pulses that come in very regularly, aside from some jitter that you can remove by statistically by long-time observations. And when the gravitational wave sweeps across the Earth, it's not the stretching of space that does this. The gravitational wave also affects the rate of flow of time and affects all your clocks on the Earth. And so you look at a pulsar in that direction, another one in this direction, another in this direction. It's an array of pulsars, not an array of telescopes. And they all should speed up and slow down synchronously, but in a with relative amplitudes and phases that basically depend on the direction of the source. And so you can pull out the pattern, the gravitational wave pattern from that as well. But it's the clocks on Earth are being affected for all of them. And this is a wonderful approach that Jim Cordes and his group are involved in. And then there's the anisotropy of the polarization of the cosmic microwave background, which operates in the frequency band 10 to minus 18 to 10 to minus 16 hertz. And that also is very close to success. I mean, it's been seen, the particular anisotropy pattern, so-called B modes, have been seen, but there is a background noise due to emission by intergalactic dust, which has to be pulled out and is not yet successfully pulled out of the data. And just to give you some sense of this, here are the four frequency bands, and here are sources. The Big Bang singularity should be seeable in all these frequency bands ultimately, but it will first be seen in the extremely low frequency band. Exotic physics in the very early universe, phase transitions associated with a change in physical laws, the transition from where the electromagnetic force is combined with a weak force into what's called the electroweak force. As the universe expands and cools, they come apart. The electromagnetic field is born, and the weak force is born from that coming apart. And that's a phase transition that is, it could well be a first-order phase transition, produces gravitational waves that are concentrated in the LISA frequency band. There may be other phase transitions that produce gravitational waves in other frequency bands, but phase transitions in the early universe, cosmic streams that I'll talk about, I won't talk about domain walls, but these are the walls of the bubbles of the new phase that surround the old phase, what are called mesoscopic excitations, in some sense, an oscillation of the shape of the space of our universe in the fifth dimension of the movie Interstellar, in the higher dimensions, mesoscopic excitation. So very speculative stuff, but very likely that some of this will occur, and we will see it with gravitational waves in due course. In the VLF band, supermassive black holes bigger than a billion suns. In the low-frequency band, massive black holes, 300 to 30 million suns. A LIGO's band, 2 to 1,000 suns for black holes. Then you have binary stars, soliton stars, very speculative things, naked singularities, very speculative, neutron stars, compact binaries of various sorts, supernova explosions, and so forth. So there's a great richness of things, some of which we are very confident we'll see, others that are quite speculative. There will be surprises. Some of the surprises will likely be, say, one or two of these speculative things, but there will be other things that we have missed completely. So the gravitational wave interferometers that we work with on the ground in the high frequency band look like this. This is a standard theorist version. The gravitational wave comes along. These are the Tendex lines of the gravitational wave. So they're stretching along the red direction and squeezing along the blue direction. So as this passes through the detector, these mirrors are pushed apart, those mirrors are pushed together. The fractional change in separation is the gravitational wave field H, which is a certain component of the second time integral of the Riemann curvature tensor, it turns out. But it's a dimensionless thing times L. So it's a piece of the Riemann curvature tensor integrated twice. And I'll put in some numbers in a moment. But the key thing and the whole purpose of creating the SXS project, this Cornell, Caltech, CETA, and so forth project, was to compute, initially from black hole binaries, but now also from other sources, neutron star binaries, supernova explosions, and so forth, compute the shapes of the waves for a given source. So those shapes, or so-called waveforms, can be used. This is stretching up, squeezing down, and so it's the oscillating pattern of stretch and squeeze. So they can be used in the LIGO data analysis, and later in the LISA data analysis, and so forth. And so they can be used both in searches and to extract information about the sources. So these are two waveforms. There are two polarizations for gravitational waves. That's for electromagnetic waves. So they're two waveforms. And these are the particular waveforms for a black hole that is 60 solar masses, a 10 solar mass black hole. This spins at 91% of the maximum speed, and this spins at 30% of the maximum speed. They're in circular orbits, and that's the direction to Earth. And these are the waveforms. A different direction, you'll have slightly different waveforms. You change the spins, you change the masses, you'll have different waveforms. So there's a great richness of waveforms, yeah. Yes.
Versus the orientation of the two arms of the interferometer. If those hit from a slightly different direction, would that mean, say, 45 degrees tilted, would that mean the interferometer would miss it completely?
Then the interferometer would miss this polarization. But as I mentioned, there's another polarization. And for the other polarization, the Tendex lines are at a 45-degree angle to these Tendex lines. And so this is optimal for that polarization, and a gravitational wave that's rotated by 45 degrees, which is the other polarization, that is the least optimal for this. And so you see one polarization or the other, or a mixture. So what you see is actually a mixture of these two waveforms that depends on the orientation of the detector. So there's additional richness there. And so we set out to carry out, Saul and his team, I'm the flaky theorist who doesn't do any of this science, but dreams about what you do with the output of the simulations, set out to do 1,000 simulations to underpin the dictionary, and there are about 500 that have been done now. But as I mentioned yesterday, the SXS collaboration is now focusing in, once you see a source, focusing in on doing simulations in the vicinity of that source in order to optimally pin down the parameters of the source, the masses, the spins of the binary. Numbers, H was 10 to the minus 21 for the first signal that was seen. That was sort of the upper range of what we expected to see. Multiply it by 4 kilometer arm length, that's 4 times 10 to the minus 16 centimeters. Signal to noise ratio was 24. Divide by 24, and you basically have a noise level at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters, within a factor 2. And there's really a factor 2 missing here. Truly, the noise level is at 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. And so you ask, how is that possible? And this is just to remind you, even for a sophisticated physicist like some of us would believe we are, it's good to just go through this once in a while. There's a centimeter. Divide by 100, you get the thickness of a human hair. Divide by 100, you get the wavelength of the light that's used. Divide by 10,000, you get the diameter of an atom. Divide by 100,000, you get the diameter of the nucleus of an atom. Divide by 10,000, you get LIGO's current noise level. When I first looked at numbers like this, I wrote in a famous line in a textbook called Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler. I wrote a sentence, it's unlikely that this will ever succeed. And then I spent a big piece of my professional career helping make it succeed. I did not really appreciate what was possible. And it was Ray Weiss who convinced me, of course. One key to this is you bounce the light back and forth in the arms for half a gravity wave period while the mirrors are separated, are stretched apart, say, along the horizontal direction, building up the signal by a factor of 1,000. So instead of 10 to the minus 17 centimeters for the noise level, it's, you've built up to 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. A signal noise ratio of 1, you would see a gravity wave at 10 to the minus that produces a 10 to the minus 17 centimeter displacement. It's built up an equivalent phase shift associated with a displacement of 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. And so that's what you have to measure. With one photon, if you're really clever, you can go down to about the wavelength of light divided by 2 pi, this reduced wavelength. With n photons, because of photon statistics, in principle, you can go down by the square root of n. If you use 10 to the 18 photons, square root of n is 10 to the 9. There's a 2 pi, so that gets you down to by another factor 10, and this turns out to be 10 to the minus 14 centimeters. The issue is, how do you ever do it in practice? This says, in principle, it's possible. The photon counting statistics don't have to get in the way, but how you do it in practice is the lifetime work of a large number of superb experiments. I'm going to skip over other problems and talk quickly now about the network of ground-based gravitational wave interferometers that we work with. There are LIGO in Hanford, Washington, LIGO in Livingston, Louisiana, basically separated across the North American continent. We currently have a LIGO detector called GEO600 in Hanover, Germany. It's a short detector that was used for developing advanced technology for LIGO. Much lower sensitivity because of the shorter arms, but still in operation. And it will help out if we get a sufficiently strong source. And it is left running whenever these instruments are off, just so you have it sitting there. In case there's a supernova in our own galaxy, it would see that. The Virgo detector, a 3-kilometer arms, very similar technology in Pisa, Italy. It's a French-Italian-Dutch collaboration with now some participation from other European countries. One 3-kilometer interferometer will go into operation with the advanced technology around the end of this year. Then under construction, this says LCGT, the name changed since I wrote this. It's now called KAGRA, K-A-G-R-A. In Japan, inside the Kamioka mine, where Kamiokande detectors, neutrino detectors are, will go into operation around the end of this decade. Should be taking data in concert with LIGO, say by 2019, I would hope. And then a LIGO interferometer is sitting in a box, in boxes, ready to be installed in India when the facilities are ready in India. But that's not probably going to be up and running at comparable sensitivity to the rest of the network until 2022. But a worldwide network, because we need multiple interferometers to be confident that what we see is real. So there's noise in these instruments that nobody understands. They are extremely complex. To illustrate the complexity, there are something like 80,000 channels of data coming off the interferometer. All except one are housekeeping data, telling you what's going wrong or what might be going wrong, monitoring every aspect of the interferometer and the environment. But it's an unbelievable number of data channels. So for confidence of detection, to extract the waveforms, both waveforms, and determine the direction to the source by triangulation, the time delay and the arrival time of the signals at interferometers at different locations. So LIGO is a collaboration of 1,000 scientists at 75 institutions in 15 nations. David Wright, he is the current director, and Gabriela Gonzalez, the spokesperson. These are, as seen from the air, the two interferometers in Hanford, Washington, Livingston, Louisiana. In our 1989 proposal to build LIGO, we said that we would do this in a two-step strategy, that we would build initial interferometers as a sensitivity where we would have to be very lucky to see anything, but it would be possible. Then the advanced interferometers at a sensitivity where we're likely to see a lot of things. And so that's what we did. It was not easy to get the buy-in when we were telling NSF that we would have to take two steps, and we had a lot of opposition from some powerful members of the astronomy community, but a lot of enthusiastic backing from some other powerful members of the astronomy community. This thing was controversial in that era. But to its credit, NSF bought in, the Congress bought in, and stuck with us all the way from NSF from 1990 onward, Congress from 1992 onward. The initial interferometers were built 2005 to 2010. They could see 10 solar mass black hole binaries out to 300 million light years. Didn't see anything, put interesting limits on. And then, of course, the advanced interferometers were installed between 2010 and 2015. And they were turned on in late 2014, one of them, the other one in early 2015, and brought down to within a factor of 3 of design sensitivity and began their search a few days after the first gravity wave was detected. They discovered the gravitational wave during an engineering run when they were making sure that the team was making sure that everything was ready for the gravitational wave search. The configuration of the detector was frozen immediately when the signal came in, and that was what was the configuration used then for this first run. First ran from September 2015 to January 2016 at a third of design sensitivity, so it would see 10 solar mass black hole binaries out to a billion light years, but the 30 solar mass black hole binary that was seen would have been seeable out to closer to about 8 billion light years. And it was seen at a distance of 1.3 billion light years. So the heavier ones can be seen farther. Design sensitivity will be reached by 2019 or sooner. If today, at the present time, as you could guess from the data in the first discovery paper, the event rate for black hole binaries might be roughly once a month, just because there are two events in there, a really strong event and a rather weak event. So that's plausible then. Seeing three times farther, it's 3 cubed or approximately 30 times larger volume of the universe. The event rate goes up to something like one a day. So I think that's roughly what we are likely to be seeing in a few years. From the initial interferometers to the advanced interferometers is an interesting set of steps. The initial interferometers have the mirror hanging from overhead support by a steel wire. It's an 11 kilogram mirror to reduce the seismic noise so we could move from operating above 40 hertz to operating all the way down to 10 hertz. The mirrors are cascaded. It's a cascaded set of 4 pendula. And each pendulum gives you isolation from ground motion. And the fiber is changed from steel wire to fused silica quartz, which has much lower thermal noise in it, lower random forces in it. Then we had 10 kilowatts of circulating light power between these mirrors in initial LIGO. In advanced LIGO, at design sensitivity, about a megawatt. But it will probably be more like 200 watts together with squeezing. And I won't talk about squeezing, but this is equivalent to increasing the light power. That's a very impressive and frightening level of light power to deal with in practice. You add on to the first interferometers a new mirror called a signal recycling mirror, which I won't go into its details, but it becomes a tool for being able to reshape the noise curve. Just by moving the location of the signal recycling mirror, you can change the noise curve from looking like that to looking like this. It's a function of frequency. This is the noise in the interferometer function. And so you have a tool for tuning the interferometer to go after particular sources. You're basically taking photons that previously were giving you a lot of information down around a few hundred hertz and moving them all, in this case, up to give you information around 600 hertz. So it's a versatile instrument in that sense. And then some new vibration isolation, some active vibration isolation that helps with the low frequency noise. And then just a remark that in advanced LIGO, one of the experimental challenges is that you have to monitor motions of 40 kilogram mirrors to 10 to the minus 17 centimeters. And that is the size where the center of mass degree of freedom in the mirror starts to behave quantum mechanically. And so the very act of making your measurements perturbs the interferometer by an amount dictated by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And you have to figure out how to deal with that and have that not interfere with the measurements. So the first time humans will see human-sized objects, in this case 40-kilogram objects, it's the weight of your children, behave quantum mechanically. And what's called quantum non-demolition technology is built into an advanced LIGO to deal with this. Quantum non-demolition technology is technology and techniques designed to get a classical gravitational wave signal through a quantum mechanical particle or particles, the mirrors, without losing the information in the signal, without demolishing the signal. So a phrase invented by Vladimir Braginsky. And this technology is a piece of modern quantum information science, quantum non-demolition technology, as I say, built into advanced LIGO. And we began the work planning for this in 1980, spearheaded by Braginsky in Moscow, and then by my research group, particularly Carlton Caves, and then later Alessandro Buonanno and Yanbei Chen in my group. The improving LIGO sensitivity, well, that was initial LIGO, was up here. This is the noise level in what is called strain per root hertz. You multiply by the square root of the bandwidth that you're operating in. If it's a broadband observation, that bandwidth would be the frequency itself. So multiply that to get the dimensionless noise. So this is sitting today down at about 2 or 3 times 10 to the minus 23 multiplied by the square root of 100. So it's a few times 10 to the minus 22. And getting down the design, that was initial LIGO. Advanced LIGO is better by a factor of about 3 or 4. And then today, and that's the design noise curve for advanced LIGO. It's remarkable that the team turned on, and within a few months after turning on, they were down to within a factor of 3 or 4 of design sensitivity. That's a real tribute to the superb experimental work. So these are resonances in the mechanical resonances in the system. So every wire by which a mirror hangs has a resonant frequency somewhere up in the hundreds of hertz region. And you just remove them from the data with a notch filter. And so you've got a lot of things hanging and a lot of wire resonances. And that's what most of these things are. And so you should just ignore them in practice. You just notch them out in the data analysis. The gravity wave discovery is well known now. The signal came in Hanford, Washington, as I remarked yesterday. This is the raw signal. We never expected to see a signal so strong that you would see it by eye. But all it's done here, and it was just standard, remove stuff below 35 hertz, because at present the noise below 35 hertz is quite bad. That point will be 10 hertz when we're at design sensitivity. Remove it above 350 hertz because the noise is getting rather bad there. And so do a bandpass filter. And that's all that's been done. This is the raw data bandpass filter coming in. What you see here, the thin line, is the best fit template from the SXS numerical relativity simulations, also bandpass filtered. And so it's not quite the signal you expect to see. It's distorted by this bandpass filtering. And so this is what came in at LIGO Hanford. 7 milliseconds later, this came in Livingston. Superpose them, beautiful agreement in there. And then, as I remarked yesterday, the SXS numerical relativity waveform in red. The gray is the measured waveform with noise removed. And a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful agreement.
Is that just one polarization?
It's the one polarization that is measured by the detectors, which are parallel to each other to the extent that the curvature of the Earth allows. And so they're sensitive to one polarization. It's a particular combination of the incoming polarizations, but it's that combination that the detectors are sensitive to.
I'm curious, because the question was asked before, background of the red line, which was the numerical prediction of the two different polarizations.
Yeah, but what you see with these two detectors, because they have parallel arms, is you see a particular combination of those two curves.
Right, so they have to fit the combination.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's fit as well. That's fit as well. And so, but this is what I want to focus on here. The green shows the velocity of the relative velocity of the black holes. It's coming in about 33% of the speed of light relative velocity, headed up toward about 60% of the speed of light relative velocity when the merger occurs. This is their separation in units of the sum of the radii of the two black holes. But the thing I really care about is the post-Newtonian analytic waveforms models break down around 30% of the speed of light. This particular source, basically the entire signal, has to depend on numerical relativity. Almost all, very large fraction of the signal power is in the highly nonlinear regime of geometrodynamics. So this is really the beginning of observational geometrodynamics. And in an auxiliary paper, the team goes in and analyzes, searches for ways that general relativity might be failing, and puts some very interesting limits on breakdowns of general relativity in this highly nonlinear geometrodynamic region. The beautiful agreement with the numerical relativity waveforms, and a wonderful tool for the first time to test general relativity with good precision, in fact. You never able to do any testing, but now test it with good precision in the fully geometrodynamical regime. I remarked about the masses and so forth yesterday. When LIGO India comes online, we will improve the sizes of the error boxes with regard to location enormously. The error box on that first source was huge. It was sort of like this, because we don't yet have Virgo. When Virgo comes online, a source at this location, you would localize within this long, elongated error box. So that's LIGO plus Virgo a year or so from now. When LIGO India comes online, these error boxes get much, much smaller. And so this is crucial for localizing sources in order to do look for electromagnetic counterparts and neutrino counterparts. Okay. So I think I'm going to stop there. I was going to talk also about other numerical relativity simulations that have taught us other things about nonlinear dynamics of curved space-time, but I've used up my time. I think I've talked about probably the most important topic at this point. Let me stop there.